This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hszc.org.
The first words are the most difficult, I find. By now, probably, body-mind is registering the impact of formal practice. At least, I hope so. It's a little uncomfortable. We're not accustomed to moving in the ways that we move in the practice environment. So, almost everyone encounters some resistance. I certainly do. As you know, our human karma is one of movements. And here, we are meeting movement with stillness. So, the body-mind is shocked. Even if we practice every day, which we mostly do here, when the amount of stillness goes way up, the body feels it. Additionally, we have the gift of a very physical practice. So, in addition to being still, when we move, there are lots of special ways to move and not move. And this usually creates even more resistance. So, from my seat, I can notice a lot of different things that I would recommend people do differently, but I find that, you know, measured doses of that usually work better. In Japan, of course, you get it all from the beginning, and if you do something wrong, usually you can only get away with it if no one sees you. If someone sees you, then they're all over you. Sometimes it seems kind of nasty, actually. But the Japanese are just like anybody else, any other people. There are some people who are nasty, and there are some who aren't at all. But the style of shaping someone's body of practice is usually quite abrupt and involves almost no explanation, let alone what you hear at Zen Center nowadays, which is, excuse me, could I give you a little feedback? Hardly seems necessary, but maybe it is in the West. I don't know. But the purpose is so that the formation enters the body-mind directly without a great deal of interference from the mind of preference. So very often, they won't even say anything. They'll just grab you and make you, I don't know, stand over there instead of over here, or do this instead of that. And it slips in right under the radar, which is actually very powerful and very effective. But at least in the West, people feel like that's an invasion of their something or other sovereignty. So that means that the full power of the formation is blunted. And again, that's unfortunate only because our lives seem so short. There just isn't that much time to mess around. So there's a certain tyranny of monastic instruments. We don't use the han here very much, but there are boards being struck and bells being rung, and they all actually signify something, not just for the heck of it. And the idea is that the patterns of formation that have been presented will simply be awakened by the bell or whatever the signal is. And you won't have to think about anything or decide, well, do I want to do this or not? And you just kind of set all that aside and give the body mind over to practicing the Buddha way completely. And it's sometimes a bit difficult. So for instance, morning service, that's kind of the big service of the day, both in, as far as I know, in pretty much all of Buddhist East Asia. And in most monastic environments, everyone needs to go to morning service, whether they are among the community's meditators or whatever it is that they do. Everyone goes to morning service, and in China they do that first. And services are very long, both in China and Japan. Most of an hour, sometimes even more. Ours, of course, are very abbreviated, and partly that reflects Suzuki Roshi's preference for not having too much in the way of ceremonial observances, so that people would focus on sitting practice. But even so, there's a service three times a day in the tradition that we've absorbed. So the first echo or dedication verse that comes after the first chant, there's a bell, and the instruction is, put your hands in gassho, and then you actually bend all the way over and put your hands on the floor with your head just, well, I can't do that from this place, but anyway, with your nose just about a fist width away from your hands. And then at the completion of the echo, the bell rings again, you straighten up. And during chanting, we're usually in Zazen Mudra. So there are almost countless such details, and they are the engine of formation. So it's really good if people embrace that and know that, probably some resistance is going to manifest, and that's just how it works. That's simply speaking, that's how karma manifests in our life. And gradually the body-mind adapts to this process of formation, and the whole experience of practice changes. So we can only do kind of a little bit of that here. And I was very surprised and a little disappointed to notice that when I was at Tanto at Tassajara, we could only do a little bit more there. I was very surprised. People would, you know, present some aspect of formation, and maybe a few people would do it, but a lot of people wouldn't. And I was very surprised to see this opportunity kind of brushed aside. And talking about it didn't help that much. Well, I guess that's just the way Westerners are, maybe. Many things require negotiation. So, as a result, this invaluable process of formation, even at the big Zen center, is kind of hit or miss, and mostly miss from what I see. It's like, well, all right, well, it's not the end of the world, but I think if people realized the impact that a more open-hearted adoption of formation, if people realized what the impact would be, they'd be up for it. And of course, all of the activities of formation go back to the stillness of sitting. Me of this old Zen expression. A single hair threads myriad poles. You heard that one? No? A single hair threads myriad poles. That's like the myriad activities of formation returning to stillness. It echoes the Avatamsaka Sutra with its philosophy of encountering one dharma is encountering all dharmas. That's, I guess, known as Huayin philosophy, Avatamsaka Sutra philosophy, but I think it's more than philosophy. It's a reflection of the deep experience of Dharma. Somehow all phenomenal expressions are one phenomenal expression. Any given aspect of our life as it unfolds reflects all aspects. So if that expression is puzzling to you, you're not alone. In fact, There was once a senior monastic named Chuan Ming, and he was in the community of the great master Shuang. So I think he'd been puzzling over this strange remark, a single hair threads myriad holes. So he asked Shuang, okay, when does a single hair thread myriad holes? And Shuang said, after 10,000 years. And Chuan Ming said, so what happens after 10,000 years? Shuang said, you will pass the examinations and astonish people. Whether the Chinese has that future tense in it or not, I don't know. It might not. Especially, you know, in Chan discourse, a lot of the utterances are as terse as can be. So Shuang might actually simply have said, pass exam, astonish people. The reference, of course, is to the civil service exams in China, which, you know, people say, well, that was such a great democratic institution because anybody could take them and, you know, wind up being the emperor's right-hand person. But of course it's not quite true, because you needed, if your family wasn't wealthy, you needed a wealthy sponsor. So there was money involved, of course. But anyway, that response didn't necessarily settle the matter for Chuan Ming. So later, he was in the community of another great teacher, Jingshan. And so he asked him, when does a single hair thread myriad holes? And Jingshan said, polish your sandals, reap the fruit. Now, of course, nobody polishes sandals, right? So, and obviously, the interlocutors knew that, both of them. But if one hair does indeed thread myriad holes, there isn't any 10,000 years. There isn't any now and then. And that list of, you could say, holes is endless. And if they're not already threaded, then, well, it's kind of hopeless. So here we are polishing our sandals. And again, I don't think the Chinese doesn't say, if you polish your sandals, you will reap the fruit. It doesn't say that. I bet you there's just four characters: polish, sandal, reap, fruit. And of course, good old grandfather Dogen reminds us what we're doing. He used different words, but he said polishing sandals and reaping the fruit are inseparable. So, I guess this is only day. What day is it? Two? Usually, at some point in retreat, it really starts to feel like 10,000 years. So, our myriad practices turn us away from spinning out centuries upon centuries in our minds and returning us again and again to no separation between the practice and the fruit. All those myriad holes are threaded. And by arranging the body, mind, and stillness, we are aligned with that truth. A commentator to that story said, polish sandals, reap fruit. Jingchan just meant, see for yourself. It's like, yeah, okay. Not just in Chan and Zen, but in all of Buddha Dharma, see for yourself is the gold standard. So even if we're still burdened with the folklore that, well, someone else, you know, sees it, and I would like to see it as they do. Even if we're still burdened with that little myth, we don't practice that way. At least I hope we don't. So my occupying the teaching seat is no different from Suzuki Roshi saying, you know, I have these glasses, but they're not really mine. You let me have them. He said. So I'm only occupying this seat because somebody asked me to. As part of the folklore of our lineage. So I think maybe one of the ways resistance manifests in my life is I have these dreadful headaches. And as I've said many times, they began almost simultaneously with my commitment to residential practice in 1982. I think, you know, I don't want to burden you with unnecessary life history, but I was in a kind of crisis frame of mind. You know, the first rumors of the AIDS epidemic were just kind of starting to surface. This was like in 81, I guess, or thereabouts. And I don't have really much in the way of premonitions, but I had a premonition that this is going to be terrible. This is going to be devastating. And sure enough, and I thought, okay, well, I'm sure I'm going to be swept away by this wave. And I felt like, I think I'm not quite done with my Dharma homework. So I went charging back to Zen Center abandoning the middle class life I was building for myself, and threw myself on the mercy of David's teacher, Nisan, who was the director of the city center. I have to move in right now. I said, all right, calm down. And in fact, in those days, you had to wait because they were full most of the time. So I think in maybe February of 82, they had finally an opening, which meant I could share a room with somebody. And Isan, bless his heart, said, yes, come ahead. Sorry. And I think I got my first horrible migraine in maybe May or June. So it's like, that can't just be a coincidence. I'd never had any migraine, or, you know, hardly any headaches of any kind. And then all of a sudden, I started getting these ghastly attacks. I don't know, karma or something. Of course, I'm using the term loosely. As you know, karma has a very specific meaning, and it doesn't just mean stuff that happens to you. But anyway, I don't want to keep you pinned to your cushions too long. So I think maybe, you know, some of my own body-mind resistance to the solvent of Dharma manifests as these attacks. So that's 30 years, no, 33 years now. It's kind of, I'm kind of tired of it, I must admit. So this is all a little bit of a preface. First of all, apologizing for last night. I kind of vanished after I got back from the doctor's office. And I'm kind of having another, or the same, headache is manifesting. So I hope I don't have to disappear again. But if I do, please excuse me. But luckily, a single hair threads myriad holes. Even a little bit of sandal polishing is really good. You have some questions? Yes.
Spoke of when we start to sit, we very soon come to the landscape, our karmic landscape. Then what?
You mean, what happens after 10,000 years?
I think
that's what you're asking.
I think so.
Well,
I mean, is there any hope in there somewhere?
The practice itself is the key to that magnificent landscape. There isn't any, you know, there isn't any other path that doesn't take us through our intimate landscape. There just isn't. So
it's like torture.
Yes. Well,
that's what it feels like.
Yes. So we want to make sure we're not overdoing that. You know, one can confront our karmic landscape in a way that's really, it's too forceful. And then the pushback is actually more than is helpful. So there has to be a certain kind of gentleness there, an acknowledgement of the tenderness of this body-mind, which means, among other things, there's, you know, there's a limit to how much physical discomfort we should put up with. You know, I pity those 18-year-old Japanese boys who are forced to sit in full lotus as, you know, when they enter the monastery, and they're being beaten with sticks and so forth. Now, some people are, to kind of quote Isan again, they're like clever enough to make that work for them. But many people aren't. So when we were at Tsuyoji for our training in whatever year that was, most of us there are like six Westerners, and pretty much all of us were pretty fond of practice. And the Japanese kids, you know, these boys, somebody passed a question. I don't speak Japanese, so by way of a translator, somebody said, asked us, why do you guys like Zazen? We hate it.
Interesting.
You know, that's, something's not working right, you know. If they hate Zazen, they're just not, you know, they're being asked to swallow the rice cake without chewing on it, which is like, it's not fair to them. Now, again, a few people pass through that narrow defile successfully. I'm thinking of, Hoitsu Roshi, Suzuki Roshi's son, seems to have survived. And Akiba Roshi, another person, he's particularly interesting. As you may know, he was a businessman, and he started Dharma practice, I think, when he was like 40 or 42 or 45 or something. And it was really, really hard. And yet he passed through somehow. But I'm afraid there are many Japanese priests who still hate Zazen as a result of being pushed too hard into the grinder. Now, some of that is kind of a Japanese thing, and they're kind of into that. They like all these extreme practices. I'm pretty sure Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, would have been appalled at the, the three hells? You know the three hells of Tendai practice? People have died doing that, like the running practice, where I don't remember the exact figures, but basically, once you start, you basically run all day and most of the night, except for like a couple of hours, for this incredible length of time. And then at the end, when you like can barely walk, they sit you down and you've got two bonfires, one on either side. And I think you have to sit the whole night. And then finally after that, you're done. But people have died doing that practice. And then there are two others. One is the cleaning hell, which instead of running, you clean this temple, you know, stem to stern, top to bottom, all day and most of the night. And it's like, wait a minute, did Buddha ever say anything like that? And this notion that, well, Buddha was so long ago, and we're so crummy, we need to do things like that so that, you know, we can be successful in our Dharma practice. Well, I think that's ridiculous. And also, Dogen never invented anything like that. So I think that's one thing we can credit the Japanese genius for, self-torture. But we don't want to do that here. So if our main experience of Dharma is torture, then something's a little off, and we need to look at that and make some adjustment. And if that means, how about maybe walking for some period of time instead of sitting, or lying down, or taking a break, or whatever it is, we should find that way where the taste of Dharma is not so bitter. Because bitter substances are often recognized by the body as poisonous. And of course, in a sense, Dharma is poisonous. It's poisonous to the the grip on the wrong idea of self. So many therapies are, you know, they generate some discomfort, but some, okay? So in the early part of retreat, most of what's going on in my experience is like a kind of solvent. Right? Things are kind of dissolving, and that is not comfortable. And then usually, I'm thinking of the 7-day style session, somewhere, fourth day, fifth day, there's a kind of a little bit of a coalescence. The body has succumbed, has given up much of the resistance. And so much of the difficulty, not necessarily the discomfort, but a lot of the difficulty kind of passes away or becomes irrelevant. But again, that can be overdone. And the last thing we want is to turn people off to Buddha Dharma by misrepresenting it. So how we deal with those 10,000 years is very important and has to be done very carefully. So I'm happy to work on that with people if they want. I'm not a big fan of suffering. When I was 30, I did a fair amount of it because the then abbot of the Zen Center kind of thought that was kind of cool. But that was, I think, a mistake. So I'm not into it anymore. And that's one good reason to stop this talk, because my knees are killing me. But please, ask the question, if you have a question. Yes, go ahead.
It wasn't really a question. It was just really a confirmation, actually, as probably the most novice to the Japanese forms at this retreat. I really do appreciate that. And in the Analects what Confucius gives his dialogue of basically his autobiography.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, after he's finally learned to listen, that he can follow the dictates of his heart without violating any of the rules.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that really is the beauty of a form.
Yeah.
And I really do appreciate that. I do. It's nice to have that freedom of the heart, but it only comes through the discipline and the practice.
And that's my experience anyway, yeah.
And
eventually, these forms, they sink into the body-mind to a place where, there's very little conscious engagement with them. Mm-hmm. They're just in the body. Mm-hmm. And that is very different. So, but that takes a while. Maybe not 10,000 years, but while we're polishing sandals, we are reaping the fruit, and that is my experience. Yes?
I was just wondering if you know this William Stafford poem. There's a thread you follow. It runs through things that change, but it itself doesn't change, and that's how it begins. I don't remember how I remember the last line, but anyway, your talk reminded me of that poem.
Yeah, I read that poem.
Through that poem.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if William Stafford was a Dharma practitioner, but he seemed to have some insight.
He was pretty close.
Yeah. Did you want to ask further?
No.
Oh, okay, sorry. Yes,
remembering ballet, I connect with ballet. You talk about forms, and these are old forms that go back way, way, way back.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the best teachers are the ones that can just touch you and tell you just barely touch you. But what they're doing is trying to get you to relax, for one thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that you're not thinking too much.
Mm-hmm.
And also, so everything just sinks in.
Yeah.
And you execute, one step. So it's very similar with forms, because it's allowing the brain to, whether or not you're getting more oxygen in the brain or something, it allows some way of connecting with the world around you in almost no separateness.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, you still think you have separateness because you have an ego, but...
Of course. Well, I'm very grateful to you all for joining together in this practice. Dissolving together here. So we have a little time left together, but not all that much. So anyway, it's great to be with you. So let's polish some more sandals. Thank you very much.